Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jai Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yashodha Nandana Praja Jana Rangana Yashodha Nandana Praja Jana Rangana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Narayanam Namaskritya
Naram
Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Ato Jayam Vidayet Nashtapeshu Padreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki Krishna, good morning. We're speaking on two verses today, continuing chapter 19, and speaking on text 11 and 12. And I'm still not sure which one to do, call and response. Maybe we'll do the first one, call and response. And the second one, I'll just read through it. It is. It might be a little quiet. I tend to speak a little quiet. Chapter. Anye cha divarshi brahmarshi varya Anye cha divarshi brahmarshi varya Vajarshi varya uranadayascha Rajarshi varya uranadayascha Nanad Sheya Pravaran Samitan Nanad Sheya Pravaran Samitan Abhyarcha Raja Chira Savavande
Abhyarcha Raja
Chira Savavande Arjuna Raja Shirasava Vande. Please chant. Rajarshi Varya, topmost saintly kings, Aruna Adaya, a special rank of Rajarshis. Cha, and Nana, many others, Arshaya Pravaran, chief amongst the dynasties of sages. Samaitan, assembled together, Abhyarchya, by worshipping, Raja, the emperor, Shirasa, bowed his head to the ground, Bhavande, welcome. Translation, there were also many other saintly demigods, kings and special royal orders called Arunadayas, a special rank of Rajarshis, from different dynasties of sages. When they all assembled together to meet the emperor Parikshit, he received them properly and bowed his head to the ground. Purport. The system of bowing the head to the ground to show respect to superiors is an excellent etiquette which obliges the honored guests deep into the heart. Even the first great offender is excused simply by this process, and Maharaj Parikshit, although honored by all the rishis and kings, welcomed all the big men in that humble etiquette in order to be excused from any offenses. Generally, at the last stage of one's life, this humble method is adopted by every sensible man in order to be excused before departure. In this way, Maharaj Purusha implored everyone's goodwill for going back home, back to God. And the text is also there for today, and I'll talk about that just myself. Translation text 12. After all the rishis and others had seated themselves comfortably, the king, humbly standing before them with folded hands, told them of his decision to fast until death. Therefore, although the king had already decided to fast until death on the bank of the Ganges, he humbly expressed his decision to elicit the opinions of the great authorities present there. Any decision, however important, should be confirmed by some authority. That makes the matter perfect. This means that the monarchs who ruled the earth in those days were not irresponsible dictators. They scrupulously followed the authoritative decisions of the saints and sages in terms of Vedic injunction. Maharaj Parikshit, as a perfect king, followed the principles by consulting the authorities even up to the last days of his life. So in our Vaishnava Shastra, there are numerous rishis, saints, personalities who are mentioned time and time again in Bhagavatam, which is a compilation where we have so many different saintly kings and devotees and their story of their surrender to Krishna. And this happens again and again, and not only is hearing their stories devotional service in itself, just by the hearing process, but also by hearing about their story, we learn so many intricacies of what they do and how they live. And in particular, I thought of two personalities that I felt were very important in looking at their lives specifically and putting ourselves in their shoes and stepping into their shoes. And the first one I thought of was Arjuna. And because Arjuna was faced with this existential crisis, and it came at this, you know, this moment where he had to face something that was really the most important act of his life. It was for the betterment of the whole world. It was facing his own family on the battlefield. And so we hear a lot when we read the Bhagavad Gita, we understand first his dilemma, what he went through. And if we can put ourselves in his shoes and understand where he's coming from, then the words that Krishna spoke to him, we can understand it in the same way as Krishna spoke to Arjuna. And so in the same way, I feel Parikshit Maharaj is a similar character, a similar personality in the Bhagavatam. He's a personality that we have so much in common with, actually, even though he has a really high position. He's the emperor of the entire world, and he was saved by Lord Krishna in the womb, but at the same time he holds so many responsibilities on a very grand level, and he has to make so many important decisions as well. And you know, if we think we have a lot of things going on in our life, a lot of responsibilities, we just take one look at Parikshit Maharaj and see how much of a giant kingdom and how much he had to rule. And not only that, he had to rule it at a time where Krishna had just left the planet. There's no more difficult time. He's trying to fend off Kali from coming into his kingdom. Everyone is, you know, really just feeling the loss, deeply feeling the loss of Krishna on this planet. And he's there having to manage everything. So in that case, we can really relate to him. He didn't just show us how to lead a great life on this earth. More importantly, he showed us how to lead and how to lead his body in the proper way. And so he shows how to detach materially and fully focus on the process of devotional service, mainly through shravan. Is it okay to ask if someone can get me a glass of water? Sorry, I forgot to ask. Just someone can get me a glass of water. Thank you. So in the last few chapters, we're hearing his life, and we're hearing very specific details of how he led and his leadership capabilities. And here in chapter 19, we see how was he reacting to this curse. In the very beginning, he's actually expecting some calamity that is probably going to come because he realizes that offending a Brahmana is no joke. And so when he hears of this coming, he's already mentally prepared. So we see first his mental preparation. And right now we're seeing a very important decision. And he shows how to make decisions throughout his life. But the most important decision one can make is what will they do at the time of death? And how will they prepare themselves? And in fact, he had a death sentence for 7 days, but for us, we don't know when that will come. So that decision is happening every single day. We have to consciously make a decision every day. How are we going to prepare for the time of death? How am I going to do that in this moment? Even though I'm not aware when that time may come, I have to be prepared at all times. When I was at UF, I was helping a little bit with the campus Krishna Club. We called it Campus Krishna. And so that was the first experience I had doing any kind of university preaching, any preaching really in general. And so I asked the devotees from England for their advice. They have this really large system of university preaching called Krishna Conscious Society, or KCSOC for short. And they do really, really well. I mean, every university has 20, 30 students at least, and all the universities, major universities in London have a KCSOC, and they have it over like arching system for what they do, how they give classes, etc., etc. They told me, well, the first thing we do is we always start off with, our first session is called, what would you do if you had 24 hours to live? And they would go around the campus and they would ask all the students, they go student to student, what would you do if you had 24 hours to live? And people never were asked that question in their entire life. What am I going to do? And there's so many, I know, all kinds of answers, and I'll party all night, or I'll be with my family, whatever was most important to them at that moment. They want to do that fully before they leave. But it's such an important question that it never comes to people's minds. So here you can see that that's actually something very important, and Maharaj Prichard had the privilege of understanding what is he going to do within the 7 days that he was sentenced to. But that he's showing exactly how to make that decision for all of us that we have to do on a daily basis. So we can examine closely kind of his mindset during this period. How does he act? What are the nuances of what he does while he's deciding how he's going to prepare to leave his body? So it's really relevant. These two verses in particular show, I think, how a great devotee and leader acts in such a scenario. And how he acts is quite humbling. And what he does is he first offers his respects to his elders, to a senior, and he first gets blessings, and he first asks for their sort of say counsel and feedback for his decision. And he doesn't do this whimsically. He does it, what we say in parampara, and according to Guru Sadhu Shastra, his decisions come from a higher authority, and it comes down in that sense. So the first thing in text number 11, it says how he offers obeisances to all the guests and shows respects to those who come. And here Prabhupada says in the purport, the system of bowing the head to the ground to show respect to superiors is an excellent etiquette which obliges the honored guests deep into the heart. So I was thinking when I was reading this that it's such a simple activity that we do, offering obeisances. In fact, we take it for granted. We do it all the time. Every day when we come into the temple, we see Tulsi Devi, maybe when we see respected devotees or sannyasis, and then he inquired with folded hands. So this aspect of offering obeisances, it puts one in a humble position, in a lower position. You're taking the highest point of your body, the head, and you're putting it on the lowest point, the ground. And it's a very, if someone does that to you, what is the automatic response that comes? Usually it's hands out, either for blessings or please don't, or embarrassed. But usually the elicited response is you show respects, you receive blessings. In the Vector Devotion, there are 64 angas of bhakti described. And Rupa Goswami, or Srila Prabhupada, states in regard to this, that the 64 items of devotional service should include all of our activities of the body, mind, and speech. The regulative principle of devotional service enjoins that all of our senses must be employed in the service of the Lord. And so they're sort of categorized in different areas, that there's different devotional service and activities in the tongue, such as tasting prasadam, or the nose, smelling the incense, or the flower that's been offered to the Lord. And then there's also the physical body, such as doing parikram around the temple. And also one of those items is offering obeisances. So thinking about this in terms of in modern context, actually offering obeisances and bowing down doesn't always have the most highly regarded connotation with it. It's something that can be seen as showing possible weakness, showing fear, or even showing as a victim of exploitation, bowing down to somebody else who's forcing you to bow down, who's a dictator. So it doesn't always have, it's not looked upon in modern times in a very favorable way. It can be seen as really a heavy gesture. But in devotional terms, in spiritual life, a devotee offers obeisances to someone who is worthy of respect and to someone who is full of knowledge. And I think, until I read this, I never really stopped to think about why am I even offering obeisances in the first place? And am I doing so consciously? And as children, we run in the temple, and our parents tell us to offer obeisances, we'll have the quickest half-second obeisances, hit the floor really quickly, jump up, and keep going. It was just the most etiquette kind of thing. We never really thought about it. But here it came so much from the heart that Prabhupada said it elicited, a feeling within the heart of the respected guests. It softened their heart. It made them feel so loved, respected, and appreciated that they wanted to give blessings. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he mentions four motivations in general for performing any activity. This can be any kind of work, or you can apply it for sadhana. And here we can apply also to the activity of offering obeisances. So the first motivation is fear. I consider motivation on the lowest level. We do something out of fear. For example, if we're talking about work, we don't do our job properly, there are consequences. We get laid off, etc. There's a warning, or this and that. The second level is reward. So we do something to get something in response. We do a job in order to make money, to get fruits for one's labor. And even higher than that is doing an activity with a sense of beauty. So in this sense, we do something because it's our dharma, it's what we do. We have some sort of identification with the activity itself. Or perhaps we're talking about sadhana. So then with a sense of duty, we've taken a vow, and we're honoring that vow. It's a respectable act. But then Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions the highest motivation to perform any activity, and this is the highest motivation to perform activity in bhakti, should be done with love, with devotion. On a material platform, one may do their job or do what they do in a daily activity because they love what they do, and they love the people they're helping. And so this is very much a mode of fitness way of acting. And so these categories can be applied to offering obeisances as well. Are we offering obeisances out of fear? And when I mentioned in the material connotation, obeisances can be seen as something more on the side of the meaning or very heavy activity. They might see it in terms of this first level. The first motivation is that, no, I'm not doing it because I don't want to do this out of fear. But then the more we think about this activity, which is an act of devotional service, it's not so much for reward. We're not offering obeisances saying, Krishna, I'm bowing down to you and I'll give you something. And we may do it with a sense of duty, which is that I felt I'm on sort of the level that offer obeisances is the etiquette, which is something we do. But really the most important way we can do it is with a sense of love. Because when we do it with a sense of love, then this is a loving response from the person we are offering obeisances to. But more than that, what he was doing here for Krishna Maharaj is that he was bowing down and offering his respects and eliciting blessings from these great saints. You know, he's in a position where he's ready to fast until death, and all these great saints come, and it says in verse number 13, actually tomorrow you'll hear that he was astonished. He was astonished that he felt he performed such a heinous act of offending a brahmana, but here still so many great saints are coming to be in his presence, in the presence of what's about to happen. And so he wants their blessings. So I was thinking about this topic of blessings and what the power of blessings really are. And blessings are the fuel by which we perform devotional service. Without blessings, there really isn't any bhakti. And in modern terms, the idea is that based on your own strengths and abilities and intelligence, that's how we go about. So this is ascending path. The more strength we have, resources, the more power we have, the more we can do. But in devotional terms, it's the opposite, the descending path. The more we are considering ourselves in a lower position, in a humble position, the more we can invoke higher power, or you can say higher blessings from above. And just like water kind of falls from a waterfall from top to bottom, in this way, a devotee understands blessings and mercy, kripa, comes from top to bottom if we put ourselves in that lower position. Blessings make the impossible possible. And that's something very amazing, because in modern terms we think we can do something if we put our mind to it. But in devotional terms, we can do something if we make ourselves humble enough to receive it. There's a wonderful verse that's often spoken before devotees give class, and that's Mukam Karoti Vachalam Bangum Langayate Girim Yat Kripata Maham Bande Paramananda Madhavam. It says Mukam Karoti Vachalam. A person who cannot speak Mukam, he can become an eloquent speaker, Vachalam. Someone who cannot walk, Bangum, they can cross over even a great mountain. And this is coming from the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. From this mercy coming down, even this impossible task of a layman can become able to speak, or if a man who cannot walk can cross even the greatest mountain. How can they do this impossible task? Simply by the blessings of the devotees and the blessings of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the shloka alerts us to this point. So how do blessings come into our life in the first place? How can we attract this kripa shakti? How can we attract it to come into our life and also receive these blessings? Well, one was to approach. The approach aspect has to be there. And Prichit Maharaj shows this approach in a humble way by offering pranam. But I thought of two ways in particular, and two examples of attracting blessings. Right. The first aspect is that we can attract blessings by simply going very sincerely and humbly and just asking for them. Just asking for one's blessings in some regard. And it can be with the simplest thing, or it can be, you know, just in general terms, please give me your blessings to perform devotional service nicely. Please give me your blessings to chant nicely. Or it can also be the aspect of eliciting blessings from another by doing something to soften their heart, doing something to please them. So for the first example, which also this is the story that I want to share, it talks about also the power of blessings, and it's quite incredible. Before the battle of Kurukshetra started, from both sides, the Kauravas and the Pandavas armies were there, they were ready to battle, and Yudhishthira Maharaj puts down all his armor, he puts down all his weapons, and he heads in the direction towards the army and camp of the Kauravas. And Bhima sees this, and he thinks, well, what is he doing now? We waited 13 long years of exile, and here we are, just ready to take revenge, just ready to do right to all the wrongs which they've done to us. And he can think of all that's happened, what's happened to Draupadi, what's happened to them in their years of exile, and he goes, he's probably going to ask for peace. But out of respect, knowing that his older brother is a leader, and he will follow him wherever and whatever he does. He puts down his weapons, he also does. And Arjuna was also present, also the younger brother. He was just been heard about Bhagavad Gita, just ready to fight. You know, all his doubts had been finished, and he was totally prepared, put down his weapons. He went also to follow Yudhishthira Maharaj. So first Yudhishthira Maharaj, he approached Bhima. And he went to Bhima, and he first touched his feet. And he said, "Grandfather, I've come to ask for your blessings. I want to fight with you. Please give me your blessings to fight with you. What an incredible thing. Please give me your blessings that I can fight with you." But it was so humble, it was so sincere, and it elicited such a loving, heartwarming response in Bhishma Dev. So Grandfather Bhishma said, "Tathastu, okay. You may fight with me." And then in tears his eyes, this is so difficult for Maharaj Yudhishthira, but he understood the power of blessings, the power of approaching elders and getting blessings for what's the greater good. And in this case, he said, "Please give me the blessings that we can defeat you, that we can heal you, that we can defeat the Kaurava army." I mean, what a thing to go up to your own grandfather and say this, but he understood that this is what was needed in order to be successful. So, Grandfather Bhishma, understanding all of this obviously, fantastic, may he be successful in defeating us. And he went to all his elders, he went to Supracharya, Dronacharya, and he did the same thing. And Bhishma Dev said, "Had you not asked for blessings, you and the whole Pandava army would have been killed and defeated. But since you asked for blessings, the whole army of the Kauravas will be killed instead." And of course, Bhishma Dev was in a very precarious situation. He was on the side of Dharma, and he was happy to see that Yudhishthira Maharaj, who represented Dharma, understood what the Dharmic thing was to do, and that was to ask for blessings. And because of this, they're victorious. Of course, because they have Krishna on their side and other reasons. But this is emphasizing that power of blessings. And it's also emphasizing the fact that he simply, very humbly and sincerely, just went up and asked for blessings. It can be that simple. It can be that simple. But in another sense, I was thinking of the pastime of Narottam Das Thakur and receiving the greatest blessing of big initiation from Lokanath Goswami. And so his heart was set on this, and he first went and asked Lokanath Goswami. And he asked for this, "Can I take initiation from you?" He said, "No, I don't. I made a vow, I will not accept disciples." And so he did not give up, and he elicited these blessings in a different way. So every night he would go to that place where Goswami would have stool and urine, so whatever his toilet, essentially his outdoor toilet. And he did that special job of cleaning it. Take coconut leaves, he would kind of sift through the earth, he would make it clean, he would put clean earth there to clean his hands, and he did it as a regular service. And the most menial service, but he didn't tell him. He did completely out of humility, and completely with no trace left behind. And then he would hide the little coconut leaf room every night, and Lokanath Goswami had no idea what was happening. So one night, Lokanath Goswami stayed to the side, and he said, "I'm going to watch and see who is doing this." And so, he waited to the side, and he was astonished to see that this is Narottam. And every night Narottam would come, and he would do this, the son of a king, with the most menial task. And it really, he felt embarrassed that he was doing that. At the same time, he felt so heartwarming. He felt so much that, wow, he's so willing to take initiative. He so much wants the mercy, this mercy that comes straight from Krishna through the spiritual master. He's so willing to have that he's willing to do anything, even clean the place where he's the bathroom. Not only doing it, he's doing it so humbly he won't even mention that it's him. But he's doing it purely out to elicit, purely to do service for me. And in that way, he got the blessing. So there's two ways you can get blessings, or a mix of both. But really, the idea is to be very, very humble and very sincere in our approach. And from that, the empowerment comes. I was mentioning earlier that the material terms is that we do something based on our own strength. based on our own merit. And there's this nice story from Srila Prabhupada from London, stating that, kind of exemplifying that it's not based on our own strength, that's not our own intelligence, isn't our own qualification for bhakti. So he was invited to the Mensa Club. I'm not sure if you've heard of the Mensa Club, but the Mensa Club is this very prestigious, high IQ, the world's oldest and most renowned high intelligence quota club, and it's founded in London. And you need to rank in the 98th percentile of this IQ test in order to be seen as a member of the Mensa Club. So it's very, very prestigious. So when Prabhupada was in England, he was invited to speak there. And so Prabhupada was speaking on this subject matter that he said, only people who satisfy Krishna, they can be satisfied. He gave the example that from Bhagavatam, if you water the root of a tree, then you can nourish the leaves of the tree. But if you just water the leaves, then the whole tree doesn't get nourished, and eventually the leaves will fall off and die. So by trying to satisfy the leaves independently of the whole, nothing is gained. But satisfying the whole, all the individual leaves are nourished. In the same way, we are parts of the Supreme Whole. And by pleasing Krishna, ourselves are taken care of and nourished. So if he's speaking like this, and the leader of the club stood up and said, Swamiji, I beg to differ. He goes, if you give water to the leaves, you can make a very delicious beverage called tea. And his point, in a kind of cunning and joking way, was that you don't always have to go to the roots. You don't always have to serve the Supreme Whole. What about tea? You take the leaves itself, and then it gives such a delicious flavor. And in that way, we can also be independent. And he thought it was a very clever answer. And so Prabhupada, he just kept going along with his lecture, and at the end, the same man came to Prabhupada, and he said, Swamiji, one last request. Can you also take our intelligence test? Can you also take our Mensa IQ test to see if you are high enough to be in our club? And Prabhupada said, intelligence is not very important. Intelligence is not very important. We have our own test. How devoted are you? How much devotion do you have? And the man who believed so much in IQ, that was his, you know, his way of showing that, yes, I have the ability. I myself am in control because I am so smart. He was baffled. And so your own intelligence, that's not very important. So why is one's intelligence not very important? You know, even though the material world considers high intelligence to be so significant. So because high intelligence and material strength and abilities, they don't bring you Krishna. And that was Prabhupada's point. But devotion does. Krishna will only be obtained by if you receive his blessings ultimately. And his blessings generally come through devotees. That's the medium by which we get kripa. And we're all mercy seekers, and that's our path. By receiving mercy from the spiritual master and from devotees, only by that means are we able to worship Krishna and get Krishna, not by our intelligence. And so this is where the whole aspect of blessings comes from. And the starting point is what Parikshit Maharaj shows here. It's just by offering obeisances, by humbly putting yourself in a position to receive, then we're on the right path to approach Krishna and eventually attain love for Krishna. So that was the first verse, but the second verse, he does something as well, which is, I think, shows us a lot of what to do in general when coming in contact with any important decision. So whenever you have any large decision to make, or actually Prabhupada says in the verse in the purport that any decision in general, it's important to first seek some authority, and so that your decision is coming in a proper way. It's not coming whimsically, is his point. So Maharaj Parikshit sets this example. And so we all have to face decisions, small or big decisions, and all decisions as a devotee generally have some criteria. Either you're consciously thinking of this or inherently it's there, and that criteria is, how will this decision affect my Krishna consciousness? How will it affect my service? And this could be something as large as which ashram should I be in, what my occupation should be in, where should I live, where should I send my children to school. It could be as small as you know, should I have this extra suite at night? Should I be able to get up in the morning and chant my rounds? And every little decision generally is connected with Krishna and Krishna consciousness in our practice in some way. And but there's also always one decision that I feel whenever devotees talk about the best thing they ever done in their life, the best decision they ever did, it's usually to become a devotee. And that's the best decision I ever made when I took that book. The best decision I ever made was when I left home to see Srila Prabhupada, or something along those lines, is to become a devotee of Krishna. And as a devotee of Krishna, we hold the greatest responsibility, actually. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in Chaitanya Bhagavat, he calls over Nityananda Prabhu and Haridas Thakur. And he said, Suno, Suno, Nityananda, Suno, Haridas. Listen, Nityananda, listen, Haridas. He said, Sarvatra Amar Agya, Koroho Prakash, Prati Gare Gare Gya, Koro E Bhiksha. My command, please know, is that go from house to house and beg all the residents, Bolo Krishna, Vajra Krishna, Koro Krishna, Siksha. Please chant Krishna's name, worship Krishna, and teach others to follow Krishna's instructions. So as a devotee, this is our main responsibility. And so earlier I mentioned how Krishna Maharaj had the greatest of responsibilities. And we hear so much about his leadership prowess and his abilities. And we hear so much in Bhagavatam about that. And often we might think, well, I'm not a leader. I'm not in a leadership position. I'm a small person doing small things, and how does this apply to me? And yes, we might all be a leader in some regard, you know, a mother, a father is a leader, a teacher is a leader, being even just of an older age, you can be a leader to younger children, be a leader to those peers that you have, or et cetera, et cetera. But beyond all of this, we have a leadership position, we're in a position that we have great responsibility. And ultimately, a leader is one who is in a capacity or position to influence others. And as devotees, we have this. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is requesting, Lord Nityananda and Haridas Thakur, but really requesting everybody who was a follower of him, please go. You know, go house to house, go person to person. Tell them about Krishna. Tell them to worship Krishna, to chant his holy name, to follow Krishna's instructions. And because of that, we have great decisions to make. And we have very important decisions to make. And so I heard something really nice yesterday on this topic of decisions and knowing if you're seeking advice like Maharaj Pariksit did or making large decisions, then how do you understand the quality of that advice is given? Because you can get advice and it can take you the wrong direction, and then you say, well, Ram Govinda, I followed your advice, so go seek advice before making a decision and look where it led me. We also have to know what's a good advice, what's a bad advice. So Ravana, who is actually very scholarly, even though he's a demon, he speaks in the Ramayana after Hanuman comes and wrecks havoc in his whole kingdom and leaves. You know, he brings all the advisors and says, look, Rama is coming and I need advice. And then he was saying there's three kinds of advice. And the first kind of advice is superior advice. Actually, he first listened to three kinds of people when he talked about superior, uttama, madhyam, kanishta, but not in the aspect of devotees, just in general. There's three levels of people, superior, middle, and lower. And then there's also superior advice. Superior advice is that which is obtained by careful, objective consideration of the circumstances, and it's in accordance with Dharma, with religious principles. So superior advice is obtained with objective, careful consideration, and it's taken in accordance with religious principles. And he said there's mediocre advice. And that mediocre advice is generally given maybe after heated discussion and debate, and it's more often than not, it's based on self-interest rather than religious principles. So the whole idea of Dharma is usually thrown out the window. And it's considered an interest of oneself as giving advice. And then there's bad advice. And that bad advice is usually made out of a sense of false pride, or wanting to flatter someone else. It has no consideration of the consequences of one's actions, the consequences of one's advice that he's about to give, and no idea what this advice is going to lead to. And actually, these three levels correspond perfectly with the mode of goodness, mode of passion, mode of ignorance. So whatever advice you receive, you can see if it's coming from a place of a mode of goodness. Careful consideration, the mode of goodness takes into account the principles of dharma, of religion, what's right, what's wrong. The mode of passion is usually overrun by pride. So out of pride, one may give advice, thinking that, you know, or it's overrun by the idea of what's in it for me. There's some I take, one I give kind of scenario. I scratch your back, you scratch my back. And bad advice is generally, you know, the lowest level, which Ravana is speaking of here, is that the mode of ignorance, generally there's no belief in God, so you can throw out the window the idea of religious principles. There's no sense of duty, no sense of consideration, it's usually whimsical, and no idea what's beneficial or not. It's actually completely ignorant of what the person is asking advice for. So when taking advice, Maharaj Pariksit didn't just take from anybody, he took from the most saintly of kings who were present. And not only was it advice, he knew what he was going to do already. He already made up his mind, I'm going to be at the banks of the Ganga, and that's it. And but he still, out of respect and out of the greatness of those who are in front of him, asked for counsel, asked for feedback. And so it's important that we're in a similar situation where we're asking for advice from devotees. Also use their good judgment. Where is this person coming from? Is their advice coming from the mode of goodness? To come from a mode of passion, or if they're completely ignorant to what my scenario is. And then lastly, I want to finish with this little story from Srila Prabhupada in Mayapur. The question came, what happens, you know, if we have to make decisions and there's no authority to consult? Srila Prabhupada, what do I do? So in the beginning, Prabhupada was speaking about this idea of intuition. And we use this term, intuition. I had the intuition to do something, I don't know where it came from, and I made a decision based on my intuition. And Srila Prabhupada says, knowledge given by Paramatma from within the core of the heart is explained by the modern scientists as intuition. Knowledge given by Paramatma from within the core of the heart. They do not know where from the intuition is coming. That intuition is coming from God. It's coming from Krishna within the heart. So, and then one devotee asks, well, Srila Prabhupada, sometimes in our practical dealings we have to make a decision and there's no possibility to refer to our authority. Shall we then try to understand what Krishna wants us to do? Srila Prabhupada said, no, Krishna will give you, and that is intuition, that understanding from within. And that is Paramatma. If you are actually sincere, the correct intuition will come. It is for Krishna's purpose, then he will give you intelligence. Do like this, in referring to the verse in the Bhagavad Gita. To those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give the understanding of which they can come to me. That's referring to the intuition. That sounds very nice. Thank you. That's what happened to these two verses. If there are any questions or comments, please speak up. Yes.
Hare Krishna. Very nice. I always enjoy the Krishna. I want to know if the benediction will be diminished if the recipient who is giving the benediction is not completely pure.
If the benediction will be, I didn't hear that word.
Will the benediction be diminished or minimized if the person giving the benediction is not a pure Vaishnava?
The Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, it's like almost like a, we have the laws of physics, the laws of nature. It's almost like a law of bhakti. In the degree which we surrender, to that degree Krishna reciprocates. And I think the same goes with receiving blessings. And to the, you know, some, if a blessing comes, for example, at the moment, which I think is one of the most important blessings or events in life is initiation. And that, at that point, we're receiving blessings through Guru Parampara, which is ever flowing. It's all that's needed to go back to Krishna. That blessing will take you back. But it's also up to our sincerity, our practice, and where we are at, how much we can take to those blessings. The blessings of the spiritual master are always present. And we may struggle with how much we can take those blessings and how much effort we can put in ourselves and how much we can follow our vows, etc., etc., how purely we follow what we're going to say to our spiritual master in order to make advancement. But the blessings are there nonetheless. So we have to have that reciprocation is necessary in our part. But it's there. And the more we take upon it, the more we'll see how much those blessings can have effect in our life. Thank you.
So it does not necessarily mean that the person who's giving the blessing has to be pure. It's more your attitude of receiving it and putting it in practice.
Yeah, receiving, giving, the two-way street. Both have to go. Thank you. Yes, Trivikram Prabhu. And then Pandri Prabhu.
It's stated that when the spiritual master is approaching, the disciple offers obeisances and then he stands up to greet him. And if he doesn't do that, then it can be considered an offense. No, if the spiritual master is approaching and the disciple is sitting over there, he offers obeisances and then he gets up to greet him. If not, then it's considered offense. Mm. I have another point I want to make. And I was listening to class yesterday, and the speaker was saying that they were, when Krishna was taking Yudhisthira to meet Bhishma, along the way there were seven lakes, Samanta Panja. Those were the lakes that Parshuram had killed with blood when he killed Shakti. Mm-hmm. But during that time there were no blood in the mm-hmm. I mean it sounds like there were blood in those seven lakes. It was not. Because whenever we're quoting scriptures and things, you have to be very careful, to speak exactly what's there, otherwise it can be misunderstood, and then people will take a difference. Oh, there's seven lakes with blood inside the lakes. But they were the lakes. Maybe they had water. Maybe they couldn't have, because that had happened so many years ago.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the detail. Anyone else? Let's pick it up.
I was going to say that it was a thought-provoking class. I love the question, what would you do when I had 24 hours left?
Yeah.
And yet it's really the great equalizer. At that point, everybody's on the same level in the terms of it. Doesn't matter how rich you are, how famous you are, how intelligent you are. And that Prabhupada said to him, intelligence isn't that important. It's devotion.
Yeah.
Because really that's what carries with us, our next life.
Yeah.
It was really nice. And also about blessings, I was remembering when I was, kind of becoming a devotee. A friend gave me a Krishna book, so I was reading the stories. And oftentimes, after the stories, there was that shruti fall. That anyone who reads the story gets a benediction. So even blessings come just from hearing, just from hearing Bhagavatam class.
Yeah.
So, it's amazing how many blessings are available if you just take part in it.
Very true. Thank you for mentioning that. It's so amazing how bold Srila Prabhupada is. Like, he would go to the Benza Club, the society for the most intelligent humans on earth, and say intelligence is not important. It's amazing.
It's so great.
It's so fantastic, yeah. it's true when we think about what do we do to have, you know, they're asking this question to university students, but you ask yourself too, sometimes they'll all have different answers, even though they're devotees, but probably mostly these emotional answers. It would vary. Yeah, that puts us all on an equal platform. We think of ourselves
is that,
all.
Is that lecture available in Prabhupada Speaks?
I heard the story recalled from someone else, but I was trying to Google search for the Prabhupada Mentor Club. It must be there. But it takes some research, for sure. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, everyone. Dr. Ashwin Bhagavatam, please. Srila Prabhupada. Oh, sorry. Not yet. I didn't realize you had a mic. Please, go ahead.
You touched on that, you know, bowing down, maybe now it is considered, you know, negative aspect. And I was thinking that how we hear about Prabhupada asked Brahmananda to pay obeisances to his mother, and he was kind of shocked, you know, that you want me to do that, you know, she's not going to understand. But you see that Prabhupada did instruct to do that. My question is, to what extent do we do that, like follow the mood, the instructions, and do we so much need to care about what people may see, or will they eventually see the humility and appreciate, or maybe that's not the thing to do, time, place, and circumstance, and you don't do that, or is there any other way to express humility to people nowadays, or humility is just not considered, is just considered a weakness, and so you just act arrogantly?
I mean, offering obeisances is a physical activity that's showing the inner mood, so to say, the inner intention of offering respect, of being, just of offering respect. That's one very simple term of way of saying it. And if that's different culture to culture, there may be something within someone else's culture or for a particular person that does that in the same way. Traditionally in Vedic culture, is offering, touching the feet of the parents every morning. That's a traditional Vedic Indian culture thing to do. And it's, for that culture, it may work. You know, it may not work so much in another culture, but the idea of what the Thakur is saying, the level of we're doing the activity, is done out of a sense of duty, which is the third level we're speaking of, or more high, is done out of love. And if you want to do something out of love for someone, we should see what pleases them. So, can be a little mindful and see how it works for different cultures, different people. For devotees, usually offering obeisances is standard, it's okay. But even that can be uncomfortable. You know, I remember being in the ashram and someone meets you and hi, roll the boom and grab your feet and it's like, oh, get off me, I don't want this right now. But some kind of understanding, if they're going to do it with love to show respect, what would be the best way to do it with this person? Okay, thank you. Thank you.